Be yourself, trust yourself, study like crazy, never stop learning. I think my strong point when I teach is encouraging people to let go of their own limitations, here and musically. And then we can talk about how to build one's career, how to play music so it grabs the audience, it's not just something in your head, but it kind of relates to everyone. Then we do all these other things. But I find that a lot of people are restricted by their own mind. I'm just good at that. I'm just good at just giving people a kick and just going, open up, shine.
I was honored to speak with the inspiring musician Polina Shepherd. In this episode, you'll hear her stories from growing up in Tatarstan, finding a bridge to her Jewish identity through klezmer music, founding Yiddish and Russian choirs in the UK, and so many other creative projects. During the episode, she sings songs from different traditions, including one of her compositions, and is such a warm and engaging speaker. I trust a wide audience will find inspiration and food for thought in her perspectives on education, mentorship, creativity, health, identity, connection, and collaboration. The link for both the podcast and video is linked with the full transcript in the description, along with Polina's website. Hi, Polina Shepherd. Thanks so much for joining me.
Hi, Leah. Wonderful to be here.
I actually discovered you through Josh Dolgan when I was researching him last year. I came upon a video you'd done together, and I was just amazed to discover your work.
That's very pleasing. I love Josh. I love his work. I love what he does. I love his diversity and his modern thinking, and the fact that you got to me through him is very validating. Thank you.
And I was just telling you before we started recording, last night I just happened to hear Psoy Kotolenko live in my city, Ottawa, and the klezmer world is very small. It seems like a very international.
It's interesting because it's a world that is very, very wide. It's basically wherever you go in the world, you'll see people who either know you in person, you know them in person, or they know somebody who is a close friend of theirs. It's a small, thin layer, but around the whole world. And I love it. Yeah, that's true.
And one of the things that strikes me about you is during the lockdowns of the pandemic, you were one of the most successful people, I think, in the world at creating a wonderful sense of community. Do you want to start by talking about that project, the Sing With Me sessions? Mm-hmm.
That was something really new to me. And since then, I've been doing things online, but that was a first. Basically, you know, I teach choirs and I usually work with people, with groups of people a lot. Several times a week, I teach big workshops, and I realized that I'd miss all that. And when I came to that realization, I was also sick with COVID myself. And I remember just lying in bed and just coming back to kind of conscious, being able to think, I need to do something because everything has been will be shut down for months, I realized. So I thought, well, what can I do? So I started, you know, thinking about Skype, and then I saw people doing something on Zoom. It was the end of March, I think. Everything closed down here on the 13th or something of March, and I started my sessions on the 20th of March. It was quite quick. So I think part of my kind of success that so many people came to me was because I was one of the first people to do it. I remember being like almost not able to sit upright, but still teaching that first session. And suddenly there were 60, 70 people in my session. And despite all the challenges, it was very, very basic Zoom, cheap, free Zoom for 30, 40 minutes. I didn't know what to press. I didn't know how to share screen. I didn't know what to do. But I was there. The people were there. I recognized some of the faces, some people from my choir, some people from America and Iceland and Brazil, which was amazing. There was still a sense of community, a sense of connection, and the sense of actually, you know, energy changing through the session. There was a huge sense of giving and taking and exchanging, and that was amazing. We ended kind of every session almost in tears because of that profound sense of connection despite what was happening in the world. And then there was another project of mine and that I collaborated with Yefim Chorny from Moldova. We did this whole big festival of Yiddish singers from all over the world online. That was over 2.5 months, twice a week. Concerts and discussions. That was also huge. So I found myself really, really busy. And I think it was therapeutic for me, not just for these people who came and they said, yeah, that's therapeutic to be somewhere, to have an anchor, to learn new songs, to engage your brain, but also for me, because I felt I was doing something, you know, something good, something good. We still carry on, not as often, but yeah, it's still, there's still a group, there's still, you know, people whom I wouldn't otherwise see. So,
still, yeah. And that resource is up on your YouTube. You have hundreds of videos people can.
Oh yeah, check. All the sessions were then on YouTube. Sheet Music is on my website. So now I ended up with like an archive of all these songs with Sheet Music, with some explanations, a paragraph or two. So it works for me in terms of gaining material as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and you grew up with a lot of singing in your childhood. Yeah. Do you want to speak to that experience? What it was like?
That was, I just thought everyone was like this, but it's apparently not. In Russia, people do sing more, even now. And certainly in my time in mid-70s, late-70s, when I was growing up, this was one of the most common things to do when a family would gather. A group of friends would gather, we'd gather, we eat, adults would drink. And my aunt and my mother would sing in harmonies, and my grandfather would play piano. And my father and my uncle would join in with their singing, which would be not very much in tune, but they still would do it in a very enthusiastic way. And we just had this way of connecting through singing together. And my brother learned to play piano and guitar, and then the elder brother, he is 4 years older than me. And then eventually when I was 7, 8, I was able to play 3 notes here, 2 notes there. And I loved just joining as much as I could. Eventually, I became the family accompanist by the age of 11. My mother sung as a semi-professional at some local concerts, and she needed an accompanist, so I learned how to accompany my mother. And it wasn't my family before it became my profession. Even though I was going to the music school from the age of 7, still, this was my musical outlet. This was where I learned how to relate to people through music, how to communicate through music, how to collaborate, how to listen, how to either lead or accompany. And it was a great way of, you know, it's just a great joy to sing together, and it's still there, whether it's professional, whichever circumstances I find myself singing in, it's just always something special, you know.
And I should have asked you, often my guests, if they're going to share music, they like to play music at the beginning of the episode when they're warmed up. Would you like to share some music now?
Ah, okay. Well, in that case, maybe I should sing a little bit of something that my family used to sing. How about a Russian art song, Russian romance?
Beautiful, thanks.
Do you want me to play the whole thing? Just maybe a couple of verses to demonstrate?
The whole thing is great. Ooh. If you want, it's up to you, because I don't know the Russian.
See if I remember it by heart. This is one of my favorite poems by Mikhail Lermontov, who is like, everyone knows Pushkin, and Lermontov is, they call him the Russian Byron. It's a beautiful poem about the journey going into the field, and then the first sight is at the field, and then we're looking at the forest, and we're looking at the skies and the stars talking to each other, and then the earth being all majestic in its blue shine. So we're looking at planet Earth from above, and then we talk about why do I feel so sad and lonely. So it's a wonderful cosmic and personal picture. And I've been in love with this since I was maybe 10, since I first heard it. So there we go. Выхожу один я на дорогу, сквозь туман гребнистый путь блестит. Ночь тиха, пустыня внемлет Богу, и звезда звездою говорит, и звезда звездою говорит. В небесах торжественно и чудно спит земля в сиянии голубом. Что же мне так больно и так трудно? Что и чего жалею ли о чем? Жду чего жалею ли о чем? I'll stop here because it's all about lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
But isn't this a beautiful, like, da 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 da, huge range. And that's what I grew up with, Russian art songs primarily. Romances, they're called.
Yeah. So from the 19th century, I presume?
Yeah. This was the music is by Shashina, who is not very famous. We only know a couple of art songs by her.
Mm-hmm.
But Lermontov's poem has been set to music, this particular one, a couple of times, and other poems have been around in songs a lot. Yeah. 19th century, beginning of the 20th, end of the 1800s, mid-1800s, and even earlier, all the way back to Glinka, Rimsky-Korsakov, Tchaikovsky, and then later, you know, coming into Rachmaninoff and all that.
I know that you have a very big vocal range, unusually large. Did your mum help you develop that? Was it that training or?
No, no. She wanted to make a classical kind of singer out of me because she was classically trained herself. So when I was studying in something like music college, it's a secondary school in Russia. I was a pianist and I studied history and theory of music primarily. Piano was my kind of secondary specialization. I went to vocal classes as my, we call these facultative, something that you can attend if you want to.
Mm-hmm.
And this teacher, although repeating my mother's thoughts, said, oh, you should be a coloratura soprano because I had this high range. And she tried to teach me how to sing classically and I just hated it. And I wish I stuck to it, but I couldn't understand when she was saying to me, sing it like this, as if you, there's a yawn, there's like high palate, this and that. I could not apply the words of how it should feel to how it felt inside my body. So I actually never developed that.
Mm-hmm.
And the way I sing high notes is not something I actually learned from anyone. I just felt it in my voice and I have this, these whistle range things.
Mm-hmm.
And I have really low notes just somehow in my voice. And it's great that I don't have to follow a system, to be honest. Being in folk music primarily allows me to experiment with vocal production, quality of the voice.
Hi, just a quick break from the episode. I'm an independent podcaster who does all the many jobs required to produce the series. And there are a lot of costs I bear as well. Please consider either buying me a virtual coffee as a tip or becoming a monthly supporter starting at $3 Canadian, which is close to $2 US or 2 euros, and getting access to unique perks. The link is in the description. Now back to the episode. So you grew up in Tomsk, your childhood. Is that how you say it?
Tomsk, but only 3 years. And then my family moved to Tatarstan, to central Russia, which is kind of above Turkey on the map.
Mm-hmm.
Tatarstan is a big republic. The size of France, it's huge. And the capital city is Kazan, 1,200,000 people. This is where I studied. So I spent from 3 till 30 in Tatarstan.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Now, I was curious about the Jewish community in Tomsk because it was dated back to the 1630s, which really amazed me. And I was curious, does your family go back that far or not? Do you know when they...
You know what? My parents only studied in Siberia. That's where they met. That's where they had children. But then we moved to Tatarstan. So I don't really have a big connection with Siberia anymore. I have an aunt who lives in Omsk, which is next door, only 200 kilometers from Tomsk, which is nothing by Siberian standards.
Mm.
But we lived in Tatarstan where the Jewish community was not as old. The main population of Jews went there during the second, just before the Second World War, between the wars, basically. So, there was a synagogue from the beginning of the 1900s, so there must have been an earlier wave of Jewish immigration there. My father was born in Kiev, and his parents were born in Odessa and around Kiev. So there's Ukrainian roots for my family, Ukrainian Jewish roots. But in terms of Siberian communities, I don't really know much, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was, you know, I knew people had been sent there at different times during Stalin purges, but I was curious to read that very old history.
Yeah.
Anyway, so when you were in Kazan, from what I understand, there was like a supportive environment for minority art and music there. Did you feel like I'm curious what you're exposed to.
Yeah, it wasn't just the place, it was the time as well, because it's perestroika, it's everything new, the Iron Curtain falling, so we had this kind of freedom to express, freedom to explore our roots, and it wasn't just the Jewish people, it was, as you said, many different groups had that, suddenly that door opened for them. So the Jewish community just began to explore, you know. There was a hidden, tiny little kind of underground religious little shtib, little house where people still all the way through the Soviet times practiced all the rituals. But it was a tiny, tiny little thing. But the Jewish community as such was built on music in Kazan, was built on music. And then they got their synagogue back, and I was very much part of that. I was right in the middle of that process. Because it was at the time when I was a student, I was young, I was part of the, I just joined the community as it was opening, as it was growing, it was as it was preparing programs, including music programs for the rest of Tatarstani wide audiences. And it was an amazing time when we had maybe 20-30% of Jews coming to our concerts, but the rest were just wide public, just coming to see what is this music. We had these klezmer concerts that were, now I realize, not quite authentically sounding, but still it was something. Yeah, and Tatars were suddenly went into this into Islam. Lots of mosques were built at that time. We had all the Volga region republics and ethnic groups rediscovering their culture at the same time. And there was a lot of exchange. There was a jazz festival that incorporated all these ethnic elements. Also in Kazan, it was a big center, a big international center. It was great and inspiring to be inside this whole movement and be just growing, growing up as a professional, listening to all these things. It was amazing.
Let's talk about Yiddish song, because you've written so much music based on poems, and I don't know, have you written lyrics as well in Yiddish, or just use other...
Tiny, tiny little simple things, but nothing complicated. And because there are so many beautiful poems, I'd rather stick to these, because my Yiddish is primitive, simple. Yeah.
Do you want to share one of those songs with us now?
Aha. Now, this is one of the earlier songs that I've written. It was maybe 20-something, more than 20 years ago. And it's about a fresh wind and going out of the house and experiencing and smelling the beautiful blossom of rye in the fields. Let me just sing it.
Und nicht gewusst, wo ein Wo ist und still geblieben. Und nicht gewusst, wo ein Wo ist und still geblieben. Von dunklen Häus bin ich heraus, dem Winterkragen angekommen, uns hat der Wind mich still und lind herumgenommen. Uns hat der Wind mich still und lind herumgenommen. Ich hab zu kurz sich mit dem Wind und meine Worte war geworden, was du dort blieb schon Korn. Es wird mich klingen ein bis Nacht, der stille Schall von weiten Ohren. Es blieb schon Korn. Es blieb schon Korn. Es blieb
beautiful. Thank you so much. You know what's strange? this morning, I wanted to show my family, who I was going to be talking to today. And I chose that song because it's one of my favorites on your albums. And I just happened to choose that and played it for them at breakfast.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Of all the songs.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Well, it's a beautiful poem by David Hofstein, who is a big figure. And I love, learning about these Yiddish poets, because this is my connection. Mm-hmm. And by writing music to a poem, I feel that I'm connecting with a big part of my history, a big part of my identity. So you see, it's, for me, it's kind of, I wouldn't say it's therapeutic, but it's certainly identity defining, mm-hmm. doing that. Yeah.
Now, you didn't grow up hearing Yiddish.
No. We all spoke Russian. And I first heard Yiddish properly when I was 16, 17, when I went to a klezmer concert mm-hmm. in that Jewish community in Kazan. It was one of the first concerts, and I suddenly hear this weird music, and everyone plays in octaves and sings in octaves and unisons. Why aren't they harmonizing? Oh, because that's authentic. Weird, interesting, though. Yeah, and that's where I heard Yiddish, and then I heard it firstly being sung and then being spoken, and then I went to study it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so your dad had taken you to that concert, correct?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And he had heard some Yiddish as a child?
Yes, he did. In his family, they spoke a little bit of Yiddish. His grandparents spoke Yiddish, but not his parents, which is quite a common story. I know that for people in the West, that's a common story, because people immigrated, parents didn't want to teach their children Yiddish because it was the old world. And it was the same for Soviet citizens, because they were all parts of the Soviet Union. Everyone spoke Russian. And before it became kind of frowned upon, it was not a cool thing to do. Mm-hmm. Not a cool thing to do to speak Yiddish. So we're all part of one country and speak Russian.
Yeah. I've been studying Yiddish for a couple of years, and it's really helped bring me back to my Jewish identity, I think, in a very meaningful way. And a lot of people don't realize what a rich secular culture it is. And I know mm-hmm. some of the songs you've set were actually erotic Yiddish poems.
Oh, yeah.
By that woman, yeah. What's her name? Troim Katz Handler?
Yes. Yeah. She was 94 when the Yiddish Book Center published that book.
Yeah.
And I was doing an interview for the BBC World, I don't know, one of the BBC programs, mm-hmm. and Aaron Lansky, who is the director, I don't know what the actual status is, but he is the founder of the Yiddish Book Center. He was on the show, and he mentioned that book. And I, as I was speaking about my composition and everything, I thought, oh, Aaron, thanks for that. So then I contacted her children, because I wanted the book and I wanted permission to write songs to these poems. And then I got the book, and oh my, it's not just erotic poems, it's like proper, really, it's more than erotic, some of them. It's quite descriptive, but it's also emotional. And I thought, okay, can I do this without tastefully? So I've chosen a few poems, and it was actually part of this festival of Yiddish song that I mentioned to you earlier, that international Zoom festival that mm-hmm. Efim Chorny and I organized. Everyone performed. It was one of the shtick about this festival, but that everyone had to perform a new song, or a new arrangement at least. So I challenged myself to write this new cycle. It was a 20-minute cycle that I presented at that festival. And that, unfortunately, has been one of very few opportunities for me to sing it. And it needs a big grand piano, and it needs a lot of adrenaline to actually mm-hmm. perform that cycle, because it has all the ups and downs and huge range, kind of these squeaky mm-hmm. things. Yeah, that was fun to write. There's no rhymes in the mm-hmm. poems. Yeah, rhythmically it's all over the place. It was interesting.
Yeah, and it's so interesting that a woman in her 90s is publishing this kind of volume.
Mm-hmm. I think she wrote it earlier in her life, and it's mm-hmm. two volumes. So this was the second one, I think. I think the first one had been published earlier. I'm not sure when, but it took all that time for a book like this to get published. Mm-hmm. But hey, we have it now, though. That's great.
Yeah.
And Yiddish has everything.
So your husband, Merlin Shepherd, also your musical collaborator, how did you guys meet?
oh, here's the reason why I'm in Britain.
Yeah.
I was a student. As I was getting into this music, I felt that I needed to study it a little bit more because we didn't have enough sources. And I went to a klezmer festival in St. Petersburg and then in Crimea, 1999 and then 2000, where Merlin was teaching. He was brought as one of the professionals from the West to teach us back our culture that we had lost. So then it all happened, and it was quite a story, but it was a big musical excitement and telepathy between us from the very beginning, which kind of hit us, and we had to think about, oh, what do we do with this all? So yeah, through music, through Yiddish culture, through klezmer.
What was it like? I mean, you went through, you know, the Cold War and then Perestroika and then immigrating to England. That must have been such a culture shock. What was that like for you?
Oh, yes. Well, being younger helps. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking if I were to move now, I don't know. But I was 30. Right, I was 30. And I just had to follow my heart. It was difficult. My language wasn't that free. I got lost in conversations, especially in pubs where there'd be like two or three conversations and loud music happening at the same time. Culturally, I didn't know many things, obviously, because I hadn't traveled outside Russia. I think I'd only been to America once, and maybe out Czech Republic once and Germany once. That was it. So I didn't really know much about, certainly about British culture. So, you know, strange experiences, like you turn up and people offer you a cup of tea, and it is a cup of tea. In Russia, if somebody offers you a cup of tea, it's tea and biscuits and sugar and lemon and maybe some, I don't know, something to go with, like chocolates and pancakes, and it's a whole meal. And also certain ways to express oneself when somebody says, oh, concert was interesting, read between the lines and things like this. Yeah, I think I'm okay now. I can understand. I can read between the lines, and I also think that moving from one culture to another, one gets perspective. That's not just this and that. It's above the two cultures. So being able to go outside one box, I think makes me able to look at these boxes from above and then see what they're about and see similarities from what kind of. What people meet, what people's intentions are, what a musical, a song's intention is, through kind of the filter of its musical language, through the filter of its language, verbal expression. So what's behind that? I think I've kind of, that's what I like to focus on, especially dealing with different cultures, different musical cultures too. Mm-hmm.
And some of the songs you've written, you've combined languages as well.
Yeah. Especially with Psoy, you know, with Psoy Korolenko, when we create these programs, he's very much into linguistics and linguistic twists, and he would mix languages and root of the word and prefix and suffix and all that, and all those word plays. So when we perform together, by the way, we are hoping to perform again in 2023 in America, maybe in Britain too, in London. He kind of encouraged me to do that, and I think, oh yeah, okay, it's. You don't have to be purist about these things. You can actually play with these things. It's postmodern somehow, but I think it's good. Your audience limits, of course. Mm-hmm. But then maybe sometimes it's not that important to know what the words mean. Mm-hmm. Because, you read between the lines.
You'd mentioned your first trip to the US, and I saw on YouTube there was a old video of when your quartet Ashkenazim went to New York, and you were, I think, at the YIVO, and someone said, oh, I can introduce you to Lauren Sklamberg, who you now are friends with and collaborate with.
Yeah. That was 2002, I think. You know, our first trip, our trip was planned for to be flying on 9/11.
Wow.
And yes, and one of our quartet singers didn't get a visa. Out of the four of us, one didn't get the visa. So we postponed our trip to 2022, to April next year. And that was interesting. And then we turned up. There was America in that state. That was interesting. But in terms of these Yiddish experiences and getting to know people, getting to meet people who were heroes for us, it was also very inspiring, very encouraging. We also gave a concert at Arbitrary, at the Workers' Circle, where our great teachers, our heroes, Adrian Cooper and Zalman Mlotek, who had taught us these songs back in Russia at these Klezmer festivals, they put this concert on for us. And everyone was in the audience, everyone we could think of. All the, I don't know, Itzhak Gottesman was there giving us the book of his mother, who is a composer, and Jeff Warschauer was there, the beautiful musician, and Michael Alpert was there, the star of Yiddish, authentic Yiddish music, and everyone was there. And meeting these people was, you know, I think it gave us a great, certainly it gave me a great start, a great kind of boost of self-esteem, should I say, as a musician, that doing this was worth something. And I think it was also when I realized that this music is wider than just these little festivals where we study our culture. It's more. It has a meaning. It has this, it's historic, you know, it has a historic meaning. But yes, Lawrence Glamberg, you know, when Nikolai Baradulin said to us, do you want to meet Lawrence Glamberg? It's like, do you want to meet Tchaikovsky? Or like, you know, and Lauren was one of the reasons why I sing Yiddish songs, because I had these klezmatics recordings, and I just loved his voice, and it was a visceral response. You know, I felt turned inside out when I heard him singing, and then suddenly he's there. Yeah, so imagine my joy now being able to sing with him.
This would be a good moment to talk about a Thousand Voices project with him. Mm-hmm.
Oh, not 1,000, quite.
Not 100. Sorry.
I wish. Yeah, 150 voices.
Yeah.
We managed to get it done just before the pandemic. Oh. Yes. So 150 voices is a choral project where I brought my four choirs. Then I had four choirs in Britain, two Yiddish choirs and two Russian choirs, two in London, two in Brighton. So I brought these four choirs together. Lawrence Glamberg came here and we recorded with them. We had 2 hours to rehearse something and we had one day to record it. And then I flew to America and we recorded it with a wonderful community choir, a Besser Welt Yiddish Chorus in Boston, Yiddish choir, with whom I'd had a long, and Lauren as well, we had this great relationship. And we also spent 2 hours rehearsing and then we went into the studio and we recorded a few songs. So it's a mixture of Russian and Yiddish songs that we either wrote for this project or we picked from various sources. And the intention of this project, should I say, is to bring people together. It's about bringing people together. It's about creating something maybe not perfect musically because of the because of who we are, because of how it was done, amateur choirs, but a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of connection, a lot of love for these musics. Mind you, in my Russian choirs, maybe a fifth of people speak Russian. In the Yiddish choirs, 3 or 4 people spoke Yiddish. In the Boston choir, they do, but not so many. So it's people connecting to each other, to culture, to music, through these songs. So we got this done, and then the pandemic hit and we finished the actual kind of process of putting it together as a CD during the pandemic. And the plan was to go to various groups and choirs and teach that repertoire and have concerts. So me and Lauren would go and do it, and we'd sing our duo material and then sing this stuff with the choirs. But then the pandemic kind of interrupted it all. But I'm so glad we did it. I'm so glad it's there. There's recorded material.
Yeah, it's beautiful. So, and the I saw your episode of the Crown with one of your Russian choirs.
Just now. That was fun.
Yeah, it's amazing. Like just a little, they used too little of your beautiful music, but it really enriched the scene so much. It just deepened it to have that authentic sound in there.
I'm pleased that we did this. And we only sang 2 minutes, so they used 1.5 minutes mm-hmm. in the Crown, which is excellent. Mm-hmm. There's a group of children there that's kind of, it's like us singing almost, you know, the full half of the song, and there is this little bit that children sing on top of that, and they had a session over a whole day, bless them, and they ended up with 5 seconds, and we still have quite an important, I think, musically, bit there in the crown, even though people can't really see us, but doesn't matter because our singing is more important, and I had to take the solo. It's written for a bass, oh, and the choir. Yeah, it's for a bass voice, but I didn't have a bass. I didn't have. It happened so spontaneously. In February, they contacted me. I was in Russia visiting my family. And in March, we were already filming. So we had to learn the score. And they sent me just the name of the song and some YouTube link to someone who wasn't singing like the complete piece. So I had to research what it was, to find the score, to adjust it for our choir, to teach my choirs. And remember, they're not all music readers. They're amateur choirs. Mm-hmm. So we had to work on that. So it's quite pleasing to be in the crown. But what I also find quite kind of funny is that I got so much attention by even just putting that little thing on Facebook, like, we are in the crown. And compared to all my work with Yiddish music, with Russian music, this has been like the biggest draw, you know. Fine, if it works, it works.
Yeah. Had you watched The Crown before that?
No, and I haven't watched it since. I haven't seen the whole episode. I just watched that bit.
Yeah.
I hope it's good.
Yeah, it's interesting. I wanted to talk about teaching choral improvisation and some of the projects you've done with youth. Mm-hmm. I was really amazed to see that. Is it called Caravan?
Caravan, yeah. It's the Caravan Orchestra and Choir. It's the project by... It's three organizations who put it together. Yiddish Summer Weimar, the High Music High School in Weimar, and University of Haifa. And they bring together young people from the age of 18 to 25 from Germany, Israel, Palestine. So it's three different... And whoever else wants to participate. And we study different musics there with them. And we mix them together. And there are usually several teachers working with them from different musical backgrounds and different cultures. I've only been involved in it twice, but it's been running for maybe 6 years. And the original music director, Ilya Schneeweis, is now in America, but he wanted to move on. And I just got there and I'm so happy because working with young people, young professionals or people who are aiming to be professionals is a different kind of energy to working with amateur adults in choirs. It's a completely different thinking process, different way to relate to a group of people. Lots of, they criticize you. You don't like that. They don't want that. And it's not, can we write it down? No, we can't. They're bold and they bring creative ideas into the process. It's excellent. And it's hopefully happening next year. So it's a great project. And it's not just exchange in terms of culture. It's exchange in terms of, you know, we do everything there. We talk about life. We talk about building one's career. We talk about music affecting us and how can one live through life just doing that. And it's a tough business and all that. Plus, there are always these conversations about political things, obviously, Israel, Palestine, Germany, Jews in Germany. It's so much more than just making music together. And I love that approach generally. We have music. It does something to us. It brings us together on a deep level. But then we have all that other stuff that we can discuss, we can embrace, but on that solid platform. Mm-hmm. Of making music together.
A couple of the videos I'd seen of that showed you sort of leading an improvisation with both the instrumentalists and the singers. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. They rebelled at first, but then they got used to it. Basically, there is a piece. We all know the tune. Sometimes we don't. We just about know it. And there are functions that I would throw at people. I would say, there are certain signals that we have A section of the tune, B section of the tune, 3 section of the tune, C section. Sometimes I do this. Go around that section again, take a chunk and sing round and round as I'm singing, as I'm indicating, for example, this, that, and that to one side of the group. Then I would say this to the other side of the group. Do it again and again and again, the B section. And then I would say stop, and I would say improvise. That's my special gesture for improvise. Sometimes we agree on the general structure. Usually we agree on the general structure. For example, we sing through the arranged piece, and then we keep the D chord going. And then I would pick an instrument and say improvise, which is a mode. And they'll do something. Mm-hmm. And then I'll point at the vocalist and say, improvise, as everyone is, keeps going. And then we go one instrumentalist, a vocalist, another one, a whole group, all improvise at the same time. You know, it's very much, it happens at the moment right there. And it's about trust, firstly. And secondly, it's about musical abilities of the particular instrumentalists and singers to just throw themselves into it, and sometimes not knowing the style, sometimes singing a jazz solo over a Yiddish horror. But it all kind of works together somehow. We do talk about these elements in our studying sessions first, and then we explore. Mm-hmm. So every performance is different, and it's great fun. It's seriously great fun.
And in Tartistan, you would have been exposed to many different modes. Do you incorporate some of that into your improvisation? Like, I know you do different kinds of improv.
You know what? The Tartar music was mostly in pentatonic when I was growing up. So I have this pentatonics in my head, and I've written one specific song, Beim Teich, that's in pentatonics, but it's slightly jazzy as well. I think that the general way to build material on modes and thinking linear, kind of horizontally rather than vertically, is something I probably picked up from Tartar music and from other folk. We studied Russian folk music as well. Mm-hmm. I didn't hear it that much because in the villages in Tatarstan, there wasn't much of it. There was Tartar music, but not Russian folklore. But we studied it, we listened to recordings. And then Yiddish music also is not vertical. A lot of it is very much horizontal. So there is heterophony, there is all these little discrepancies in the tune that, you know, it's more about phrasing and ornamentation rather than putting harmonies to the tune. So I guess that did affect me. But I studied classical music. So it's kind of this, kind of detaching myself from classical music, moving towards folklore is something that I found quite interesting. Challenging as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this advice that you would give these students about the business, like we have to be entrepreneurs as musicians, mostly, mm-hmm. What kind of advice do you give them?
Oy. Be yourself, trust yourself, study like crazy, never stop learning. I think my strong point when I teach is encouraging people to let go of their own limitations here and musically. And then we can talk about how to build one's career, how to play music so it grabs the audience. It's not just something in your head, but it kind of relates to everyone. Then we do all these other things. But I find that a lot of people are restricted by their own mind. I'm just good at that. I'm just good at just giving people a kick and just going, open up. Shine. Yeah, and then we discuss all the other things. Use social media, don't use social media, how to record, how to create a new project, should you not? And it's tough business. You know, right? It's not easy, especially if you just only want to make music. Yeah.
How about collaboration? I was hearing you talk in another interview, and some of the things you were saying I found very interesting. Because I was thinking, you were saying in terms of seeing other people's point of view or when you're collaborating with people, you may not agree with their aesthetic or their way of doing things, but you kind of have to go along or be more like water. And I was thinking when I was younger, I think I was much less of a good collaborator. I would just be too stuck in the way I wanted to play things, you know, in chamber music. Mm-hmm. But now I'm more, you know, open. How about yourself? Do you think that's changed over the years?
Oh, very much so. Yeah, very much so. Certainly, coming from classical music and Russian art songs, I was quite stuck in that. And I also played, you know, Mozart, Schumann concertos. So that was in my fingers, in my head. And I think that I like challenge, which is why I grabbed that other way of thinking. I grabbed that linear thinking as, oh, that would be interesting. That would be good. So when I started playing with a band, first of all, I had my own little youth band, and then I joined a klezmer band, a professional klezmer band. So I had to kind of adjust to all these different people with different levels of musical skill, different aesthetic values, different, you know, understanding of what music is for. You know, do you want to be a star or do you want to actually say something? All these things. I found that if I want to just say something, say what I want to say, firstly, fewer people will listen. Secondly, it'll be a weak message because I'm not learning, I'm not listening, I'm not really embracing as much as I could. It's like the multiple of the, what's the saying? The multiple, the sum of...
The sum of the total is greater than its parts.
Yeah, it's like three people, it's times one, times two, mm-hmm. times three. It multiplies the message, even though it may be not exactly the message you want to say, but it's it multiplies the message, and it does have my message in that powerful general message that the band would be giving. So I kind of learned, and also I was a young person. I was 17 when I first joined that professional band and we started touring. I learned to keep my kind of head down and voice down, you know, because I was with professional players. And only then I thought, well, maybe I can raise my voice a little bit more. But that's a great skill. Also, I think that learning to see goodness in other aesthetic, in other people's tastes, challenges my worldview, expands it. Mm-hmm. So if somebody can see goodness in schmaltzy chords to an authentic folk Yiddish tune, it's a weird combination. Why would you? But then so many people love it. Maybe I should learn to appreciate something understandable, something that relates to people through that kind of music. I don't know. I like learning. I like learning. It doesn't mean that I will play jazzy chords to an authentic tune. But hey, why not sometimes, you know? Mm. Maybe I'll use one or two as well.
Yeah. I'm curious about memorizing because you came from this classical background. Like you seem to be able to memorize chords, play by ear, memorize lyrics very easily. How does that work for you?
Lyrics is not so easy. Mm. I'm actually a little bit afraid of singing in Yiddish because it's not my native language, mm-hmm. and because I'm afraid to sing the wrong words. And I like to have, you know, a backup, you know, I like to have something to look at. But I prefer to play by ear. I actually much prefer to play by ear. If I know a song, I can play it in pretty much any key, any tempo, anything. If I have sheet music in front of me, I can only play it in that key. And if it's complex, I won't be able to read it like all the way through perfectly. So I'm an audio person. I learned to play tunes before I learned to read music, mm-hmm. which is why I probably didn't, like, I never learned how to follow a page that well. I'm terrible at following what's written. And then I teach Rachmaninoff to my choirs. Oh, there is a missed piano here. I missed that, you know, and I have to bring myself back to being accurate with classical scores. Mm-hmm. But it's much easier for me to just play how I feel, to invent tunes as I go along, right here, right now. Yeah. I like that. Mm-hmm. Spontaneity.
Yeah. I was wondering about like keeping your voice healthy. You've toured a mm-hmm. lot in the past and hopefully now more that things have been lifting. So do you have any advice for singers or things that you watch out for?
Oh, the main advice is to keep yourself in good mood, healthy mentally and emotionally and physically, and sleep enough, eat well. I go running, mm-hmm. you know, and maybe sometimes it feels tough. Like today I went running and it was raining. I got soaking wet, completely soaking wet. But today it's difficult. But overall, my energy level since I started running has gone higher. And now that I have a big tour coming in America and Europe with Apollo's Fire. I don't know if you know them. They're a Cleveland-based Baroque orchestra. Mm-hmm. That will be over a month and a half, and then I have a theater project in the middle in New York. I have to learn things about it's a long stretch of, you know, work, and having to sing sometimes 5-6 hours a day. I must do something for keeping my energy up. I can't just function normally. There needs to be an extra something. So I think that doing something on a regular basis, like running, like I don't know, Wim Hof, there are all these, you know, physical things we can do is excellent, it's great. I used to have sore throat all the time as a young person. I used to lose my voice all the time. I could not sing for 20 minutes without then having a sore throat. So I had to think about it. And also alcohol, especially when touring, it's tempting to, you know, chill out after a concert and just have a glass of this or that, sometimes to give yourself a boost before a concert if you feel low energy. But I've realized it's like with running, it's good for that particular day, feels good for that particular day, but in the long run, it's not good. In the long run, it takes your energy down. Mm-hmm. So I've stopped drinking now altogether. And there was something else I thought about. Yeah, there are all these technical things like not drinking sour, like lemon or anything like this, not drinking milk before a performance, obviously not smoking, and all these other tiny little things. Yeah, but taking care of yourself. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Have you done any of those Wim Hof breathing exercises or cold exposure?
No, I've heard about it and I've read about it. A friend of mine does it. But it seems too intense for me. I just can't bring myself to doing it. I used to take cold showers as a young person. I think I've overdone it. So I am very bad with temperatures. I'm very sensitive to temperature. Mm-hmm. I can tell if the water running in the tap and I'm 2 meters away from it, I can tell if it's hot or cold. Yeah, so not Wim Hof, but they say it's really good. running is what I do. Running is quite, and it's, you know, it's, I think I'm quite proud of myself. It's 10 kilometers, you know, it's not just nothing. It's good. And thanks to Lawrence Glamberg,
yeah,
who was, you know, a runner, and he encouraged me to do that. And we even run together when we're on tour. Let's mm-hmm. go for a run before a concert. Yeah, let's do that.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
You've done some, it's funny, so many of the musicians I've talked to recently have accompanied silent films. And that's one of the projects you've done with Merlin, right?
Yes, true. That's also quite different to everything else I do. It's a special way of thinking. It's a way of connecting to something visual, right? It's relating to a film through music. And it's amazing because we kind of mostly improvise through the whole thing. So in 2005, when Merlin and I were at Glasfest Kiev in Ukraine, the director of Glasfest, Yana Yanova, and her husband, I think they had a friend, Oleg Morozov, who worked at the National Cinema Studio, and they were just throwing these films away, you know. And he said to these directors of Glasfest, "Hey, do you have any use for these? These are Jewish films. There's Jewish content in them, content." And they said, "Yeah, great. Wonderful, we'll have them." So they share, we were chatting and they said, "Oh, we have these films and they are on these old, what are they called, acetates? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you want to use them somehow? Do you want to show them in Britain? Do you want?" And Merlin said, "Why don't we play music to these films?" And it felt interesting. Let's try. Yeah, so we did it. We had a tour in Britain in 2005. We showed our films in Kiev, maybe 2006. Actually, Marina Lerner was there in the audience, and Adria Cooper were there watching these films. They are from Ukraine and generally Soviet Union. From 1910, mm-hmm. Russia, Ukraine, to 1926, Soviet Union. Personal stories, community stories, building of collective farms in Crimea, mm-hmm. A documentary, a Polish, anti-Polish Jewish propaganda film, lots of propaganda, obviously, in these years. Very interesting. Some of them are known films, some of them are less known. Some of them are not full, not complete. So we have something like, I think, 17 films, but we've played only 6 films so mm-hmm. far. So what we do, we translate them into English, if there are subtitles. And we see, certainly we want to relate to the year when the film was done. So if it's 1913 and there is a traditional Jewish wedding, we play music from a traditional Jewish wedding that would have been played at that time in that place. Mm-hmm. And then there is a Soviet tune, and there's these little pioneers, youth marching in the fields in the Soviet collective farm. We play something that relates to that. And there is some original material, and we have this general thread of what suits which scene. We have that general kind of scheme, but then we improvise. And because Merlin also loves improvisation, we can just throw things at each other. And sometimes we, after a film, we say, oh, why did you play it in that key? Oh, why did you? Oh, but that worked and that didn't work. And let's play it like this next time. Every time is different. But it's amazing how we, when we play these films, every time a film turns a slightly different turns a slightly different face to us, and we decide to play in a slightly different way, and it colorizes the film musically. You know, every time, you know, it's great fun. It's, and they're amazing films. It's amazing cinema. The last project we did was during the pandemic, Five Brides. It misses. There is no last reel, so we assume that the Red Army guys saved these poor little ladies from a Jewish shtetl. But we don't know. We just see them with their red banners, you know, and their horses, but we don't know. And then it says the end. So we play positive music, thinking there is a positive ending, but we would love to one day have kind of a theater performance, like a mixed media project where we would have several people performing the final scene as we are continuing to play. So the film stops and then people go on stage and perform it, and we play. That would be so great.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful.
It's a fantastic, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Have you done collaborations with dancers?
No. My only collaboration with a dancer was a teaching project, not a performance project, when we mixed Jewish nigunim, mainly, wordless tunes, and Afro-Brazilian dancing. I have a fantastic friend who is originally Spanish. She lives here and she studied Afro-Brazilian dancing. She's a dancer, and we put these things together for people who have no access otherwise to any kinds of culture apart from their own mainstream, you know, television and radio mm-hmm. culture. We worked in women's centers. We worked in groups with mental health issues. We worked for elderly people. And we just taught them something different, just to take them outside of what they know. Sometimes we would mix things. I would sing and she would dance and they would copy us and they would sing with me because it was easy to sing without words. So nigunim are great for that. And sometimes it would be just the movement and then just the singing. But it worked, you know, it worked really well. It wasn't culturally specific. So we weren't building, you know, we weren't teaching people about the culture, but we were using these cultures to give something different to mm-hmm. people, to get them outside of their box. So that was the only thing. And I miss it. It was fantastic.
That's really
good. It was
good.
Quite a long time ago. Yeah, it was one of the first projects I did here in Britain, 2006 or so. Yeah.
I'm curious, Polina, do you have like an idea journal for things you'd like to do, or?
Yeah.
It's all in your head.
I like to manifest things. I have an idea, and then I sometimes write it down. I used to write them down, and then I stopped writing them down. What I do, I have an idea and I have a vision of how it should be. I sometimes have a visual of a stage and particular people on the stage, a specific town, city, where this would be performed, for example. And then I put it in my kind of timeline that this is going to happen in about a year or two. It's going to happen. And I just like to assume that somehow. If it doesn't happen, it's not a big deal, but I'd like that to happen. And I keep it somewhere there. I like to play with all these, you know, intentions, visualizations, and all these mind techniques. At least, I don't know if it's wishy-washy. I think that it, if anything, it allows me to focus on something, and it allows me to do certain things that would be steps towards this project. Like 150 voices, I had it in my head, and I just thought, I want to bring my choirs together, and Lauren, we're working together, and he loves choirs, and it would be great to do this material. And in a year's time, it all happened. But what happens is that I get little signals from the universe, from my outside world. Oh, we have a free day, and Lauren is going to be here, and my choirs are available. Oh, that's a coincidence, isn't it? And I have this project in my head somewhere there. Oh, that'll work for the project, you know? And a lot of things happen like this. Hmm. They just happen because I think about them. I put them somewhere there. I manifest them.
When you started your choirs, was it all like, because it's such to even start one choir is a huge project, but you have four. Hmm. How did that come about? How did you make that happen?
It's funny. I never taught choirs in Russia. I co-taught a community choir in the Jewish community in Kazan, but I didn't consider myself a choir leader at all. I was actually excused from choir sessions in school, in the music school, because I had this chronic, you know, throat thing. So I never actually, never considered myself a choir person. But I think Merlin said to me, why don't you try and organize a singing group or something like this? And I thought, well, okay, maybe I actually would love to do it. And you know, sometimes when somebody says something and it just really, there's an internal response, I'd love to do that. It just, something rings the right, you know, the right sound there. I'd love to do that. So I contacted the local synagogue, Reformed, Progressive Synagogue, and I had three people turning up for my first session. But then one of the ladies there liked what I did, and she just happened to be a fantastic person to know everyone, all the communities, she knew the academia, she knew all the community people, this community, that community, venues, and she still is a fantastic support and help for me. Jackie Fuller, she will be watching that interview. She's like my Jewish mother. She's my Russian choir administrator. She helped with the Yiddish choir here in Brighton, and she gives fantastic ideas where to put a gig, who to contact. So I guess it's, in terms of building up, it's a bit of luck and intention in place and planning long term mm-hmm. as well. Yeah. But it's also hard work because it has to be always here. I wake up in the middle of the night. What's with this choir? What's with that choir? What do we sing for that? I need to send them that. There's a JPEG I need to prepare. There's a song I need to write an arrangement for. And, you know, everything is in my head all the time. And everything has its own little place. And I have to filter. I have to go through every single unit all the time and put something as priority, put something as I'm coming to this next week. But it's a lot of calculating here in the head.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I'm curious, you've worked with all these community musicians who don't read music. I don't know how they manage to memorize all that choir music. What have you learned through teaching them?
honestly, I learned that I want to teach with sheet music, which is what I do now.
Yeah.
I started teaching as a natural voice practitioner. There is a whole movement here, Natural Voice Practitioners Network. And I was part of that network. And the principle, one of the principles there is to, first of all, teach anyone. Anyone can sing. And secondly, no sheet music, which is fantastic, that sense of freedom. And I still teach folk songs like that. I prefer to teach them like that. But when it comes to classical or something in the middle, I like to have sheet music. What it taught me is, you know, a switch from visual to audio perception is a huge switch. And when people are not looking at their sheet, they're much more committed to the music. They're much more in the moment. They are listening to themselves and to everyone else in the group much, much, much more. It really gives such freedom. I love that. On the other hand, if I want to teach something more complex and to speed it up, I do use sheet music. And then I prefer it when people know their material by heart. It's much nicer. It's much nicer, but it's not always doable. Plus, we've started singing complex arrangements, dissonant arrangements, 20th century kind of Russian classics. Sometimes with Yiddish choirs. With Yiddish choirs, we sang Der Katerinchik in Yiddish, in four parts, Schubert. Six pages, you know, you can't imagine that people would learn that six-page material by heart. So for these, it's nicer to use sheet music, of course. But it's a completely different way of relating to music and performing it, and presenting it. Yeah. I think I like to a mixture of everything. You know, all the questions you're asking me about styles, about young people, you know, professionals, amateurs, everything, cultures, this culture, that. I like to mix things. I like to mix, and I like to maybe to be resourceful, to use this from that, and that from that, and use the best of all the worlds.
You had mentioned some of your early mentors, like Adrian Cooper. What kind of lessons do you remember learning from that time?
With Adrian, the main lesson, well, first of all, she just showed me how Yiddish songs should be. She showed it by making it very deeply personal. So she would never sing a song. She would always sing a song as if it was her own, as if she was really opening her heart wide and presenting her heart like this to you. And it felt like it was directly personal to each one listening to her. And that, like a goosebumps every time. And that way of singing was new to me, especially with Yiddish song. Because Yiddish songs were, I liked Israeli tunes. I liked Hebrew stuff at that time. And suddenly I hear Adrian. So I learned that Yiddish song can be still relevant, can be personal, and can be modern sounding, can be kind of right here, today, expressing me right now. So that's one thing. She taught lots of vocal things, you know, she taught lots of, you know, just like professional skills to us. But that, I think, is the biggest thing that I learned from Adrian, this personal, complete commitment to a song, full commitment, homework, to get into the song, to give it your own voice. Should never perform a song like others. It would always be something like different. It would become a different song and should sing it. So that was really, really important. And I think I like songs to be personal, to be emotional. Zalman Mlotek, who is the Volksbühne music director, I'm going to see him hopefully in March because we're doing something for Volksbühne. He was just a brilliant teacher in terms of how to accompany, how not to play over the vocalist, how to support them. Even little things like if you play a melody high, in the higher register, it will acoustically be, you don't need to play it loud, but it will be there for people to pick up the tune if you need to give them the tune. You're helping by playing in a higher range, not in the same range as people are singing. So these tiny little motifs, these tiny little things were really, really useful. And he's a brilliant accompanist. And I also was learning how to accompany as well as sing myself. Actually, I think some of my first class fest, I was accompanist to vocalists who would come in front of the class and sing any song, whatever they wanted to sing. And I would hear the song for the first time, not knowing it, and I'd have to figure out how to accompany it. And that was Zalman's ideas and his teaching that helped me to do it. So these were the direct teachers right there. And of course, Lawrence Klamberg, I think I mentioned Frank London, I mentioned Merlin as my teachers, and each of them gave me some other angle of this general professional attitude, just being and being a musician.
Mm-hmm. Merlin's clarinet playing, and I guess he plays sax. Does he play other wind
instruments? Yeah, he plays guitar really well. Electric guitar is his other side. Yeah, but saxophones and flute.
Has it taught you, like, collaborating so much with a wind player? Like, he's very free with his music. Has that helped you?
Oh, yeah, very much so. Because of this, you know, I sometimes sing as if it's an instrument. I treat my voice as an instrument. And I think that I've learned some things from Merlin. Like, he would, there are two ways to play a note on the clarinet, and he uses it as an ornament. Mm-hmm. Not just him, but clarinetists use it. He plays with that sound a lot. And maybe because of that, I learned to sing a note with kind of changing the color of the note, still holding a note, kind of going in and out of this, and he does that too. So all these little ornaments, I think I picked up a lot of it from Merlin, and just sometimes screaming with your instrument rather than playing it nicely. So he has this few saxophone solos on some of the early CDs that we recorded together. And it's really screaming. I dare screaming sometimes. Mm-hmm. We have this song, Psoy Karlenka, and I have a song in which I'm supposed to make people uncomfortable by singing really high and in a kind of very piercing way because of the effect. The effect is to make people shiver. And I think that without listening to Merlin, just going for that sound, daring, I wouldn't dare myself to do this. But I like that. I like that exchange. Again, going outside of the box of just the voice. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the voice as an instrument.
I'm curious, what are you doing with Apollo's Fire? What kind of repertoire?
Yiddish.
Okay.
Yiddish. So they have a program called Exile. With four different vocalists, and each of them will be, it's a mixture of different cultures, and each of them will be bringing their own culture into the project, and they're arranging it, and we will sing a few songs together. It's not yet decided which songs, but they'll be from different, this mixture of mm-hmm. cultures, and I'm bringing Yiddish songs to the project, and I'm really, really looking forward to it, because it's a fantastic orchestra, they're beautiful, and singing Yiddish songs with an orchestra, a Baroque orchestra, it'll be interesting. You know, it's kind of contrasting in a way, this folk way of thinking and then more formal, more arranged classical sound. I'm really looking forward to how it'll turn out mm-hmm. in the end.
Yeah. I was wondering if you'd be willing to consider performing a Niggun.
Oh, yeah. Okay, let's do this one. It's called Koyach, which means power, inner strength. I die,
Thank you. It's a real privilege for me to have what feels like a private concert, but everyone in the world can enjoy your performance. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's been a real pleasure hearing all your history and your stories today. I'm just wondering to finish up if, you know, you've gone through such changes in your life, and, you know, when you moved to Kazan and went through all the opening of the Iron Curtain, you couldn't have imagined your future now.
Yeah.
Is there anything you might have said to yourself at that time in terms of the future that would have helped, or maybe you didn't need help?
Oh yeah, I did. A lot of things were tough. Yeah. A lot of things were tough. I just think if I met myself when I was 17, I would just hug myself and I would say everything will turn out okay, because there were so many challenges. There was a lot of uncertainty. What was around me, what I had to kind of, I wouldn't say fight against, I don't like that word, I would say I had to overcome a lot of things. I would say keep going step by step, step by step. Rely on the positive human nature, and there are good people everywhere you go. There will be support, there will be love, there will be music, good music, and people who love music everywhere you go. Because this finding your own audience, finding your own voice and relate to that audience, I think has been the biggest challenge, professionally speaking. And if I'd known that, you know, if somebody had told me when I was 20 that I'll have a project with Lawrence Glambrook, that I'll be playing with Merlin Shepherd, that, you know, all that Adrian Cooper would record my own song that I composed, if somebody said that to me back then, I would be over the moon. But I'm over the moon now that I've done all these things. So I think trusting myself is something that I probably had, but I wish I had more of that. And I think that it's just generally something that we need to do. We just need to trust ourselves, trust the heart, trust what, follow intuition, follow, like, I don't know, follow some kind of soul connection. I don't know how to word this. It's something deep. It's something that just feels right, something that should feel right. And that's like a moral little indicator, that moral little catalyst. This feels right. This feels, whatever feels right here will happen, will manifest, will be in reality. And if I have an idea, that seems crazy and impossible and not realistic, if it feels right, then it will manifest. And that knowledge, I wish I had it back then, and I have it now. And I think that that's something I have to hold on to, because with all the political crazy things now happening in my country, actually my three countries, I have to have some kind of ground. And I guess that's the ground. And the people all over the world, the people whom I meet over Zooms, over, you know, programs like this. And thank you very much, because meeting you and even the fact that you wanted to interview me is huge support. It means a lot. Thank you.
Well, it's been my honor, and I hope that people will check out, of course, in the link they can hear your albums and see what you're up to currently.
Thank you very much.
I hope you enjoyed this episode with Polina. Season 3 continues with a wide variety of musicians worldwide, sharing their perspectives on a life so enriched by music. Please help this series find new listeners by sharing this episode and rating and reviewing the podcast on Apple Podcasts. If you sign up for my newsletter through my website, leahroseman.com, you will receive lots of sneak peeks for upcoming episodes. Have a great week.